Hey everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is Friday, January 12th, 2024, and this is episode 789 of the podcast. And we have a very special episode celebrating some documentaries and friends of the podcast. We have returning to the podcast PJ Raval, who is on here some years ago. He'll be up first with his new documentary, Who We Become, and then we're going to have on the producers of a documentary that I've been talking about for the last, I don't know how many months, but we're going to have on Simon Kilmurry and Susan Margolin, who are together producers on the late Nancy Bersky's recent documentary about the making of Midnight Cowboy. It's called Desperate Souls, Dark City, and the Legend of Midnight Cowboy. Nancy passed away right after she did the podcast a few months ago, which was a shock. And since then, the film has been shortlisted for an Oscar for Best Documentary of the Year. And so producers of the film, Simon and Susan, have been doing amazing work, running around doing a lot of screenings and publicizing the existence of this great documentary. And so I reached out to them to come on to the podcast and talk about Nancy and talk about this great film, Desperate Souls. So we're going to have them on afterwards. So first up here, though, is PJ. PJ was last on episode 216. Now we're up to episode 789. So this is a while ago. He was on back in June of 2014 with his documentary, Before You Know It. And before you know it, he's back on the podcast with this new one, and it's called Who We Become. And what's really great for PJ is that this film was made in partnership with Ava DuVernay's Array Releasing Distribution Company. PJ is an Austin-based, award-winning, queer Filipinx-American filmmaker. He's made a bunch of documentaries, including Before You Know It and the new one, Who We Become. He's also with cinematographer, another great documentary called Trouble the Water, whose filmmakers I had on many years ago. A little bit about Who We Become, which is currently, by the way, streaming on Netflix. Who We Become is a provocative personal exploration that redefines, quote, the personal is political, unquote, in a pivotal historical moment for today's young generation of Americans. It follows three young Filipino-American women in Texas, two in Austin, who forge unexpected connections with their families while grappling with their emerging political consciousness. Given today's turbulent times, Who We Become vividly highlights the love and work of a younger generation of leaders who are fighting to create intergenerational dialogue and change the world for the better, while capturing the unbreakable bond between family and community. Again, Who We Become is currently available for streaming on Netflix. So here is my conversation with the returning filmmaker, PJ Raval, right here on Film Wax.
This is a prayer and a reminder. All we have is now. Anak, umuwi ka na.
Worldwide this morning, growing concern over a growing health crisis.
The World Health Organization has just declared that this is a pandemic.
Hi. I can't hug you. Don't touch me.
Over the last several days, we have seen peaceful demonstrations.
Protests over police brutality continued here in Austin.
Remember when you started going to college? You came home a liberal?
Bad, please.
That's what we're teaching you guys in school.
All these people that we'd never met and never will meet because of what had happened to them. It's just too much.
The way that our family communicates is not necessarily, it's not great.
What advice would you give for those of us that are struggling?
Deal with it.
All right. So I'm alluding to the fact that your three subjects, these three Filipino American women, were obviously all three figuring out a way of connecting to the world and to their families, but at the same time trying to figure out how to make that work. Talk to me a little bit, I guess, about how you came to decide to make the film and what your relationship with these people were. And when did you start making the film? I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I originally had an idea to make a film that was going to center around individuals having maybe challenging conversations mm-hmm. with people that they kind of hold very close and dear to them. And that largely came about because I think at some point I realized in a lot of my previous films, there's usually a scene like that. Right. Where I've been following someone for a certain amount of time, and then we see them in this situation where they're with someone who they care very deeply about, and it comes to a point where they have a difference of opinion or some kind of challenge it amongst each other, and you see how they kind of navigate that kind of terrain, right? And for me, I think living here in the United States, I think there's a very common narrative of this idea of, families having difference of opinions. And I think there's a kind of common narrative of like the Thanksgiving dinner, right? Where someone is coming home to Thanksgiving and they just can't see, eye to eye with Uncle so-and-so or their dad. And then it becomes this big explosive thing. And some people just avoid going home and some people don't talk about things because it's too much to deal with, right? And at some point I realized I had a lot of Filipino American friends and community members that I saw who, though they were very vocal and outspoken, maybe about their politics, their views on the world. I would discover that many of them had family members back home who held very different points of view. So anyway, I set out to make a film that was going to explore this. And when I first did that, I kind of just put as I do for some of my films, I just kind of, contacted some friends, close colleagues, about it, and eventually, started moving on this idea, and then the pandemic hit.
I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was an idea right before
that makes sense now that you describe it like that, because I was like wondering, well, if they were shooting themselves on Zoom, why would they record all these? It's just like makes sense that they would have now already they might be participating in this project of yours.
Yeah. And I mean, essentially, I had these conversations with each of them about, what was going on in their life. What are some of the things that they were thinking about? Who are some of the people that, they're surrounded by that they would maybe want to have some of these conversations with? And then when the pandemic hit, it became very clear to me the urgency of the situation mm-hmm. And how if I'm looking for some kind of, moment where there's a moment of growth and transformation, like this is it, and thankfully all of them, agreed to do it. So it was, it was kind of circumstance and timing, but I had the idea right before going into it. I think I actually started solidifying the idea in, January was when I definitely was like, I should do this. February-ish, beginning of March is when I was starting to have these conversations, and then boom, it hit. I was like, hey,
but real divisiveness has already been existing since 2016. The start of Trump. I mean, really.
Absolutely.
So yeah. this would have worked either way. It's just that you might have had less Zoom footage, I guess. Maybe.
Yeah. Honestly, and that was absolutely it, is I felt like we were living, we still are living in very divided and divisive.
Oh, my God.
Times.
Totally. Totally. So, what is it about, though, the traditional family seems to have been one generation, it seems like. There's a real change in the Filipino community, or at least Filipino American community. I was in a relationship. I don't know if you remember last time we spoke, I might've even been in that relationship with a Filipino American person. And I mean, just from her mother to her was such an incredible change of values or of just of ways of, whatever. And many different ways politically and otherwise, socially and otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, I think, for me, what I'm looking at really is Filipino Americans, right? So the experience of these three young women who you know, are children of immigrants. So their experience is very different from, you know, their parents. But one of the things I think about is, you know, specifically in Filipino culture, the idea of like a multi-generational household is not unheard of. It's very much, you know, commonplace, less so here in the United States, but definitely in the Philippines. And there is this idea of like the different generations all living together, all kind of in close comfort, you know, that idea of like you're 18, you move out and you go to a different city. That's more, in my opinion, that is somewhat more of a modern kind of American kind of narrative, right? But the more traditional narratives, at least in the Philippines, is this idea of a multi-generational household. So this idea of having an intergenerational exchange is not foreign, you know, to Filipinos. And then I think what, you know, complicates it are these ideas of respect, right? And, you know, even in the film, we hear, you know, Lauren's family talk about that a little bit, like this idea of like, you don't talk back to your parents, you don't disrespect them, they're your elders, you know, you honor them. And I think, you know, no one would disagree with that. I think, of course, that's what we want to do. But I do think, now speaking as someone who grew up here in the United States, we're so encouraged to be like individuals, speak our mind, you know, speak your truth, like all of these kinds of things. So then there becomes this cultural kind of conflict.
Right. And it's right. And it's clear the older generation also do have a desire to understand and connect with their offspring and the next generation, even though maybe they struggle. But there, I do see that in all those parents and aunties and uncles and all.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things, you know, for me specifically, as I got older, I had to start recognizing my parents, you know, the older generations in me, they have their own experiences also. Like I mean, when I was growing up, I was very like, oh God, you know, I'm living, you know, as, you know, a queer person of color in a very conservative area. This is really challenging and difficult. But to be quite honest, I don't even know what it would be like to pick up and decide to move to a different country and leave everything that I once grew up with behind. That's not my narrative. And I can't even imagine what that narrative and experience would be like. But I think when I was younger, I didn't really think about that in terms of my parents' story. And then as I get older, I do think about these things because it's like, these are the choices they made. This is the experience they had. And it's so wildly different from mine. And to be honest, it's probably so wildly different from their parents who didn't do the same thing, you know? So I think there is something there too, in terms of like recognizing the differences. Then we also recognize kind of some of the commonalities here. Like we each have our very unique and different kind of experiences.
I forget where you premiered the film, or it's played in a number of festivals, I assume, but I was wondering what maybe the families thought of how the film came out, and, you know, were they happy with it and glad that they participated?
Yeah. I mean, because so much of the film, because the film very much focuses on, you know, this idea of self-documentation, or, you know, the protagonist kind of, documenting their experiences, I think, you know, the idea of their parents seeing their kids filming something is also not unusual. You know, this younger than me generation is very much has grown up in this like selfie, self-documentation, posting on the internet, like, you know, yay, this is what I did Friday night, you know, all these kinds of things. So I think that wasn't unusual for them. I think when they realized it was for a documentary, and for a larger piece, that was interesting. And of course I screened it for everyone before, you know, the film got released.
Of course. And
some of the reactions were really interesting, of course. And I think the largest reaction was just seeing other families and other storylines and seeing these kind of commonalities, you know, between, or them seeing kind of what they're, you know, what their child was saying, you know? So the reactions, you know, the reactions were really good. It was a lot more, I think with every documentary I make, there's always an emotional element to it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so I think seeing it all together was, you know, a really big kind of emotional moment for everyone in the film, including myself. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. When did Array enter the picture? How did that happen?
So right before the pandemic hit in 2019, I think it was October of 2019, which is Filipino American History Month, so it probably was, in Los Angeles, Array had programmed a weekend of Filipino American films.
Oh,
that was programmed by Marija Mora, who's an amazing filmmaker and also has a Filipino American curated series called Cinema Sala. Sala in Tagalog meaning living room. So I think they invited Marie to co-curate this program, and she, you know, and one of my previous films, Call Her Ganda, was one of the films. Amazing weekend. I got to meet everyone at Array. They got to, you know, meet me, see some of my work. And then from that point on, I think they were just paying attention to whatever I was working on. So then when I released this film, they took some interest in it. And to be honest, I can't imagine a better partnership than, you know, this company of like real, mm-hmm. you know, fierce, amazing women of color who are truly like transforming the film industry. So it's such a honor, you know, to be working with them.
I'm sure it is. When did Netflix come in? Was that helped by the relationship with Array? I can't imagine it would have hurt, or do they have an existing sort of deal with Netflix?
Yeah, from my understanding, I mean, you know, Array is distributing
what a great
films,
break.
I think. Yeah, and I think, you know, Netflix is one of the ways that they do it. So
had you had a film distributed by Netflix before?
My first two previous films were on Netflix, but it was also when Netflix was a little bit of an earlier.
Sure.
So I actually think
when they're producing less original content, in other words.
Yeah. Like the first film I made, I think it was on Netflix when it was still DVDs. You know, it was
yeah,
DVDs
yeah, yeah.
and
yeah,
on
I think
the,
I,
and
I think
the
I
audio.
Ordered. Yeah. I may have ordered that one actually. Yeah.
And then the second one, I think, was when it transitioned to fully, you know, on online or streaming. So yeah, it's kind of interesting to see the evolution of Netflix.
Well, people can go directly from here to Netflix, actually, right after this and watch Who We Become. So how many films does this make, PJ, that you made? You're very prolific.
This is, in terms of features, number 4.
Okay.
Yeah, this is number 4 in terms of features. In between, I've made a couple shorts here and mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
Not maybe necessarily prepared to talk about it yet, but I also have 2 other feature documentaries that I'm trying to finish up.
Oh, and here I was. Well, you're on a roll. Here it is. I was, take advantage of the time. You're obviously on a tear here, but is there ever any interest in making a narrative film?
Yeah, actually I do. Actually my background was, narrative filmmaking. So I would love to, return to it or revisit it at some point.
How did you get sidetracked?
I was working largely as a cinematographer. So I went to, you know, I did the whole, I, you know, went to film school, got my MFA.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was there doing that, I only made narrative films. And I was, and I was doing a lot of cinematography work.
And where was that?
At the University of Texas at Austin.
Austin.
So UT Austin.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was, so by the time I graduated, I was already a working professional as a cinematographer. And I mostly filmed independent narrative features, things like that. And then I filmed a narrative feature that was largely improvised, handheld, you know, very spontaneous filming.
What they might call documentary style.
What they might call documentary style. And some producers saw it, asked me if I would, you know, film some documentary work. And then that just kind of, you know, started my exploration into documentary. And then to be quite honest, at the time period, filmmaking was, I'm going to definitely like date myself saying this now, but like at the time, right? And this is like more the early mid 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, this is really before the rise of a lot of streaming platforms and before the big digital explosion. It was right around the time that it was kind of happening. So a lot of the independent films that I was working on were shot on Super 16, you know, and they had certain budgets and were requiring a certain amount of money, and it required a certain amount of cast to sign on, and someone would approach me and then it would take a while, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
And what I loved about watching documentary filmmakers were something was happening and they just grabbed a camera and started filming right on the spot. And it was just so exciting to see how fast and reactive and spontaneous they could be. And it was like such an adventure. You don't even know what's going to happen half the time. I mean,
And that, I think that was also the appeal and why they created such an appetite for, you know, film lovers and or the audience out there, because, you know, they felt the same way. They love the energy and the, I mean, you're still telling stories, you know, it's just a, you know, a much more, just a different way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so to answer your question, I would love to. I actually wrote a short screenplay that I would love to make this year. And I'm working on a narrative feature. And I actually think making documentaries has been some of the best training for me in terms of thinking about story, thinking about character, thinking about all the elements of what makes good films. So I would like to get to a place where I'm not really thinking so much about, is it doc? Is it narrative? Is it this? Is it that? It's just more like, what's the story? What's the best way to kind of tell it?
Yeah, it's a good way. That's a good way of putting it, because I think it's usually the marketing companies and distribution companies that are more concerned with those issues than the filmmaker. You know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, And there's been so many films that have sort of played with that, obviously, with that that line.
Yeah.
Can be very exciting if it's done right, you know?
Absolutely. And for me, even with this film, Who We Become, the reason also I wanted to make it was to remind myself that there's different ways of making films.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who spent so many years working as a cinematographer, who's always placed so much emphasis on the visuals, that, you know, all these kinds of things, it was so freeing and liberating to be like, you know what, I'm going to put the camera in the hands of the protagonist and see what they do. And I'm really going to explore, you know, more collaboration within this project. And I don't know, it was really freeing to kind of get away from that narrative of, you know, because having made several films now, I started falling into this narrative of like, okay, you have this idea, you have to raise a certain amount of money and all the elements of what I loved about documentary, which was just like, no, I got this idea, I'm going to go outside and start filming it now. Like that kind of started to fade a little bit. And so this was a real, for me, it was an opportunity to kind of like resurge that interest of like, what are some of the elements I really love about this genre of filmmaking? And I think what's, you know, interesting for me was when the pandemic started emerging and things were, you know, obviously pivoting and shifting, like my drive to make like increased like tenfold, like it was like exponential every day. I was like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, oh my God, what about this? Like, we got to think about this and we should be, you know, talking about this. And so again, so for me, this was an opportunity to also just kind of grow as a filmmaker.
Well, apparently so. And again, it's called Who We Become. It's on Netflix right now. The director's PJ Raval. And how's Texas? Finally, how is it, living? I mean, you're in the bubble.
I am.
You're in Austin, but
even being in Austin, we're subject to state laws.
Apparently. Yeah. It's
and
been
living in Texas, we're subject to federal laws. So it's kind of,
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a challenge. It's a challenging place to live in. I'm not going to lie, but it's also, there's some really great things about it. You know, and some great things about, you know, the people here as well. And
sure.
Yeah. And so we could talk about that for hours.
Probably so. And, you know, look, anything's possible. That we may be surprised by what Texas ends up doing in the next couple of years, like in terms of its relationship to the rest of the country.
Well, I have to also acknowledge that I grew up in California, and I also grew up in California in a very conservative part, which was Central California. Mm-hmm. And when my family moved to California, it was still quite conservative. And now it's become this like liberal beacon, you know, and I don't know.
There are parts still very, very red in California still.
Well, I mean, not to say the obvious, but even New York, right? Like everyone thinks, you know, New York City.
Oh, yeah. Where
New
I live
York
up
is
here
is,
it's very purple up where I am here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly, you know, as we acknowledge, we're living in some pretty extreme, divided times.
Right. That's why I'm going to recommend all the more people watch your documentary who we become.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. All right. And I will look forward to doing this maybe in person again someday.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It'd be great to see you in person. Maybe we can do it in a movie theater.
That would be fine with
or
me.
A theater lobby.
Exactly. Let's do it. Yeah. Like old times. Exactly. All right. Well, thanks for making time on this Sunday. I guess afternoon for you. I appreciate it. No, it's morning still. I appreciate it. Thanks for, I know it's already on Netflix, but I was kind of like saying, I got to get PJ back on. I really would love to have him. It's one of the things I actually like most about doing this thing is being able to follow somebody's career, bring somebody back on, and all the, you know, it creates kind of a community around the show, which I really, really like. So
yeah,
thanks.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, you know, the film is going to be on Netflix for several years, and you know, what it's talking about, these things aren't changing overnight.
No, no, so, no, very true. Yeah. Very true. So, yeah. For better, for worse. Very true. So yeah. Watch the film and have some rough conversations, but maybe some enjoyable conversations. The most gratifying, I think, experience is having difficult conversations and coming out of it still respecting your loved ones, your family, who you maybe have differing ideas about, but you can come together with love and respect. And I think that's what the film is about. So
absolutely.
It's a great idea. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be in touch then. All right.
All right. Thanks. All right. Good to see you.
Same here.
An advocacy group reporting at least 3,800 anti-Asian hate incidents since last March.
I'm kind of conflicted. I'm like, maybe I should move home and be here with them.
I hope that this moment makes you take a step forward and a step together in the right direction.
In order for a subject to not be taboo in our community, there always has to be like someone to start that conversation. Yeah.
You speak up for me when I can't speak up for myself. And I've seen you do that for other people.
I see a lot of people who just kind of cut off friends and family, and I don't think I can do that. I love my parents.
This is a symbol of our voices. If you look at your neighbors around you, you will see who stands with you, who stands for you.
At least I know that you can stand up. That's the thing I'm so happy about.
Next up here, again, this was a crushing, shocking blow to all of us in the indie films, documentary world sphere, if you will, when only a few months ago we lost Nancy Persky. And while she was able to be around for her the theatrical distribution of her latest documentary, Desperate Souls, Dark City, and The Legend of Midnight Cowboy, sadly, she won't be around to experience and witness the great success I'm sure this documentary will have. I have a strong sense it's already been shortlisted for an Oscar. I have a sense that it will likely get nominated, and I wouldn't be surprised if it won, even though the odds are what they are for any film, let alone a small documentary like this. But it's a pleasure to bring back Simon Kilmurry onto the podcast. He hasn't been on in a long time, many years. And this is, I believe, Susan Margolin's first time on Film Wax. So it was a great pleasure to talk to them about Nancy Persky and their feelings and memories, and also about this really entertaining and moving documentary, which you cannot really see at the moment. But that wasn't the point of this. This was about spreading the word about getting this documentary nominated, and also when it becomes available on a streaming platform, which it will, we'll be talking about the film again. So here is my conversation with documentary producers Simon Kilmurry and Susan Margolin right here on Film Wax.
I'm very self-conscious right now because I want to say something perfect and poetic and beautiful. And I just know that this picture...
Hey, God, I'm walking here!
He didn't make the movie to crusade about anything at all. He made the movie because he saw something in the culture that was great. to take pictures of. Nobody had seen those images and those midnight cowboys on 42nd Street.
Talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying.
Was the very first movie that I ever saw that was a picture of New York that really looked like New York. It didn't look like Easter Parade and Judy Garland was going to come down singing. It looked as scuzzy and dirty as any other part of New York.
He was fascinated by America, by New York, by the drama of urban America.
No matter what Joe Buck's particular delusions might be, the cowboy theme Hustler is a very, very gay thing.
The winner is Midnight Cowboy.
I'm not even sure why it got an X.
If I'm going to America to make a movie, this is the movie I'd like to make.
It manages to express the zeitgeist. It expressed its time by being of its time. Because nobody ever really knows their own time. So when people express their own time, it's generally by accident.
Hey, Adam.
Hi, Simon.
How are you?
Good to see you. Same here. How are you?
Good. Are you being hit by the winter storm?
Yeah, I guess so. But it's not that big in the Hudson Valley, at least where I am.
Okay.
It's Hi, Susan.
Hi, Adam. Hey, Simon.
Thank you both, by the way, because I've been checking out you guys on social media. And you guys are really, really working hard. Really doing a great job of getting the message out there. Starting off, I'm kind of awkward in that I don't announce it usually. Like I just start talking, but Desperate Souls, Dark Cities, and the legend of Midnight Cowboy is shortlisted. You're setting a great example of what you need to do in order to get it moved up into the next level, which is nomination.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing this with a little bit of support from some friends and family, and but a lot of fumes, and you know, just trying to ask people to watch the film, you know.
Yeah.
And that's as much as really we can do. And you know, Nancy was so excited about this movie, and also about hopefully trying to get it on the shortlist, that it could come this far. Is really gratifying.
Thank you for bringing up Nancy and, like, you know, that looming over the whole thing. It becomes even a bigger story, this whole journey that you guys are on, doesn't it? I can only speak, and I will not speak much more, but I do want to, like, say from a personal level, Nancy was a lovely person who I got to know through her film work and through my conversations with her over the years. She did this show 4 times. The last time was with this film, this documentary, and it was days before she died. You know, it was just one of many, many, many people whose life she affected, who she touched, and who were really profoundly moved by what happened. And so I can't imagine just how this feels for you guys. Can you talk a little bit about it, Susan? Because you were so closely with her,
yeah,
you know, in those
yeah.
weeks in the screenings. I saw you at Saugerties at the Orpheum.
Yeah. It's really it came as a total shock to us. You know, it just was, you know, as if like a bolt of lightning just, you know, struck her and she was gone. You know, just nobody anticipated it. And, you know, it's been hard. I mean, I don't know what I would have done without Simon, as my partner in crime on this journey. You know, it's been very bittersweet. You know, we're so just honored that the film, you know, that our colleagues, you know, thought that the film, you know, belonged on the short list. And as Simon said, Nancy really wanted to give it a shot. So, you know, we're just thrilled that we're here. And, you know, I have a lot of conversations with her and you know, keep her up to date on where things are, and you know, we're going to talk about what we're going to wear. So,
Yeah. We both
is
look great.
really,
Should we be
yeah.
so fortunate as to be
Yeah.
nominated?
It is kind of one of the bittersweet joys of this whole process is it's allowed us to talk about Nancy a lot, you know, and what, as you mentioned, Adam, what keeps happening in those conversations are stories which I didn't know of how she touched people along the way, whether it was through Full Frame, getting people, showing people first film that Full Frame, you know, getting their career started, or through her films, and that's been a real pleasure, being able to talk about her, so. It's bittersweet, but it's definitely a nice aspect of this.
Yeah, I would just add, you know, as Simon said, you know, I've been just so amazed by the number of people, you know, prominent filmmakers in our field who said, I wouldn't be here without Nancy
Wow.
Bersky.
Wow.
You know, that, you know, she invited me to Full Frame, and, you know, she introduced me to, you know, D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus and Barbara Kapple, and, you know, gave
Yeah.
me a sense that I could, you know, make it as a documentary filmmaker. And this has come from so many corners. So that's been quite beautiful.
Yeah, maybe anybody watching or listening, they may not know that she's also, in addition to all the films she's made, she's and everything else, she's also a founder of the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. Just astounding. I was going to say, I think she actually did have an impact because it was talking to her about her prior films, mostly dealing with civil and social issues over the years, you know. And even this one, she managed to find those angles, didn't she, Susan, right? And Simon. And it really had like an impact because I had been wanting, I didn't know that how much I wanted to talk about more pertinent and important issues, issues that would, I don't know. If people listened and watched what I do here with this thing, that maybe I could make a small difference in my own way. And it was talking to people like her, which crafted the show, you know, in a way and made it more, I think, important. It's like this is stuff we need to think about and talk about. It's really, it's, you know, it's great to be entertained, of course, but I think we also need to have conversations like those that the films inspire, her films have inspired. You know.
Absolutely. I mean, Nancy's films all operated on so many levels.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is the, you know, just the social issue aspect, but also just, you know, the artistry,
Yeah.
and the connections that she made, really just, you know, they were all had her signature, you know, deeply imprinted.
You collaborated with her, right? A number of times, correct?
Yes. Yes, we started
You're a
working
producing
together.
partner.
Yes, we started working together on The Rape of Recy Taylor back in 2016, as I was transitioning out of the distribution world and into producing. And you know, I was speaking with her on the phone, and we had, you know, distributed The Loving Story, and she, I said, well, I'm, you know, leaving my company, and she said, well, why don't you come and produce The Rape of Recy Taylor with me? And the rest is history. After that, we did A Crime on the Bayou together, and Desperate Souls, and we were so thrilled when Simon agreed to come on board to of Desperate Souls.
When was that, Simon? At what point?
It was right at the beginning. Nancy and I had talked for years about not dissimilar to the conversation that Susan had with her about working together. I'd always watched her films and given her notes and had these long conversations. We joked about at some point we'd love to do something together. So when she heard I was leaving IDA, she immediately called me and said, you know, let's find something to do together. And shortly after that, she reached out to both of us right after she had spoken with Glenn Frankel about this new book, and she just read it right before it came out, and we got copies of it. And the fall, like, I think over the weekend we both read it, and you know, on the Monday or Tuesday we spoke and said, yes, there's something here. So it was, we were, all three of us were on it right from the beginning. So that was real fun. That was real fun.
So tell me, what is the process? I think I've had a number of other, you know, shortlisted filmmakers on in the past, but I know, what happens there? How do you get, is there anything you can do to kind of nudge it ahead? Or is it hiring a marketing or a publicity company? Or do you get contacted out of the blue? How did it work in this case? Either of you, I guess.
In terms of getting the film to the
getting
public?
Shortlisted, because it's such a you know, such a great opportunity for any film, let alone a documentary like this. You know,
it is. You know, Nancy, like I said earlier, Nancy was super excited about this, about possibly this happening with this film. She felt it was a new language of filmmaking for her that she was exploring. She was kind of expanding her, you know, her cinematic, you know, style,
vocabulary.
Vocabulary, thank you.
Yeah.
you know, shortly after Nancy passed, Susan and I spoke to each other and said, we need to try and do this for Nancy.
Yeah.
We reached out to our EPs, who have been incredibly supportive. They helped us raise a little bit of money, but we've really been doing it through kind of blood, sweat, and tears. And it's been, we've had some support from some publicists, which is, you know, who are friends of Nancy's, which has been incredibly helpful. But it's been a very grassroots, organic effort of seeing, can we get a film to screen in different places for folks, making sure that, you know, they know it's on the Academy screening room. There's no, I think, great, you know, magic answer for how to run these efforts. I think it's really a matter of doing, you know, spending the time to reach out to people and say, we hope you'll take a look at it. And not trying to push them, you know.
Right, sure.
Not, you know, yeah. We don't try and be pushy about it. But it's just, you know, making sure that in the crowd that, you know, we hope you'll look at it and consider it along with everything else.
Mm.
That is, you know, advice that we got early on from other filmmakers who've been through the process, you know, just that the film will speak for itself. So if we can just, there are so many films, if we can just encourage, you know, in the, who have so many films that have qualified, and, you know, it, just encouraging people to, you know, watch the film and take the time. That was really, you know, the focus of our campaign, because, you know, we didn't have the budget to do fancy dinners and, you know, fancy parties, and, you know, mm-hmm. that wasn't in cards here.
Yeah. Well, that comes as a grave disappointment to me, but well, you know, and you'd think, oh, it's about Midnight Cowboy. You know, people in the industry are going to want to see an iconic, you know, film with big stars, John Voight, Dustin Hoffman. John Voight's contributed, he's involved in the, participated in the documentary. And it's, I think the first shot, remind me if I'm wrong, but isn't there even in the first shot of John Voight? Yeah, just talking. Yeah. And he, of course, very emotional when he talks about Midnight Cowboy. But, you know, I'm sure you know this only 2 hours. It's like, who knows what will the audience or the members or whomever, the voters are going to be there, you know, tickle their fancy this particular year. Who knows? It's so true. It sounds like, you know, you could have exactly the right film, but you never know. You can't know, you know.
Yeah. And there's a lot of great films. There's a lot of great films.
15 of
them. The shortlist is fantastic. And there's a lot of great films that didn't go on the shortlist. You know,
Right.
it's a very competitive, and I think getting on the shortlist is wonderful, but it shouldn't diminish those that didn't get on the shortlist. They're also fantastic.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of really great
Yeah.
films being made these days.
Yeah. I'm sure both have worked on many films that have not been shortlisted, but hey, what might have been broadcast on some major documentary series for what is the we know that Desperate Souls, Dark Cities, and The Legend of Midnight Cowboys had a theatrical, and is it something that people can see at the moment, or are we waiting for its next? I
Yeah,
forget.
it's playing, it's on TCM.
Okay. It's on TCM.
And
Perfect.
yes.
Perfect. Yeah, perfect place.
And they also did a beautiful tribute to Nancy Bersky that they ran, and they played several of her other films, Afternoon of a Fawn and Vice
Love that
Event.
film. Yeah,
Yes.
yeah.
So yeah, it was a really I believe it was on November 27th, but I'm sure that you can just find the tribute online. It's certainly on our social media.
Right. I can imagine that Desperate Souls would have made a great Thanksgiving movie, as would Midnight Cowboy, of course, always one of my favorites. Yeah. Okay. So what happens next? When do you know when you're going to hear something? If fingers crossed, your journey should take you to the next level. Do you know what that looks like?
The voting opens tomorrow, and then
Oh,
the
tomorrow.
announcement is on January 23rd, and we will hear along with everyone else on January 23rd. We'll have no advance notice. We just have to wait and watch the nominations announcement.
And my fingers are crossed, and I'm rooting for you guys and for Nancy. Yeah, that this is an could be an amazing. It's already an amazing story. So whatever happens here on is, I guess, frosting, and
Absolutely.
and you have
Yeah.
a what's and then do you also have what's coming up as far as, I don't know, anything exciting coming up in terms of showing the film anywhere in particular?
We've just come off a whole bunch of
Yeah,
screenings
I
over
know.
the
Yeah,
past few weeks
I've
at
seen that.
Palm
Yeah,
Springs in New York and LA and
right,
elsewhere. We've got
right.
a couple of final ones coming up this week. After that, I think we will catch our breath and then see what's next with the film.
Right,
But
let nature take its course. Yeah.
also our international sales agent is out there, and it's being acquired by a number of European television channels. So hopefully folks from around outside the US will get their chance to see it too.
Brilliant. Well, I have a mixture of feelings that but I'm so pleased that you guys would make the time and talk to me, and it really, I'm glad. Gives me a little bit of a little closure too, a little bit maybe. I'm saddened by the fact that I'll never have a Nancy Brisky on here again, but
Yeah.
I'll be calling on you guys instead. And so and so how many, Susan, how many films has she made in her career? How many?
She's made seven films,
Yeah. Okay.
including by Sidney Lumet and
Right.
Afternoon of a Fawn and The Loving Story. She was actually working on a narrative version of Afternoon of a Fawn called
Oh.
Tanny.
Oh, wow.
And she wrote a beautiful, beautiful script.
Wow.
So, we'll see if we can
Yeah.
get that, launched properly.
We got to do it. Of course.
We got to do
It's going
it.
to happen.
To do it for Nancy.
Absolutely. That's going to be my mission. Oh, it's not my mission, I guess, to have, but I'm on board. All right. Well, thank you both. And Full Frame also, people should check out, get on their newsletter, get on their mailing list rather, and get, you know, updated about the next Full Frame Festival and support.
Full Frame is coming back next year, and they're going to be showing a bunch of Nancy's films, the Full Frame. There'll be a tribute to her there. So
fantastic.
That's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It is wonderful. Well, again, thank you both. And, you know, I'll be rooting for everybody.
Thank you so much, Adam.
All right. Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Really? Bye, guys. Thank you. That is a wrap for episode 789 of the podcast. The big news, it's already out there, is that coming up soon, Wim Wenders finally on Film Wax. That's a big deal for me. I know I buried the lead by putting this on the outro, but I'm very excited about it. I couldn't be more excited. I talked to Wim, and as soon as his latest narrative film, it's called Perfect Days, is out, we'll be releasing that conversation. He also has a new documentary in 3D called Ensemble, which I saw at the Woodstock Film Festival this fall, and that too is coming out. So Wim Wenders, and he's working on another documentary, I happen to know that. So he is on another streak, a very productive and prolific filmmaker in his late 70s. It's good to see. And wonderful. I have a bunch more episodes in the works. I'm very excited. Actually, it's pretty great. As Film Wax is now in its 13th season. Just amazing. So take care of yourself, the ones you love. I'll be back next week with a new episode of the podcast. This is Adam Chartoff signing off for Film Wax Radio.